And we're on, or and we're off. I don't know what the expression is, but we are
I
recording.
mean, both work, which is weird.
Yep. We've done a lot of stuff since the last one, even though the last one wasn't that long ago, right?
Yeah, no, well, not been a super long gap this time. You've been very busy.
So busy. If anyone wants to see how busy I've been, check out my Codeberg. But also, I want to take this as a point to encourage you to move your stuff over to Codeberg, because Codeberg's not only really good, but when I did a merge request for Blop, was it yesterday or something like that?
Yeah.
I went into GitLab for the first time in a while, and it offered me a free trial for something. And I didn't click on it or whatever, but I'm like, I don't want to be offered a free trial. I don't mind paying for something, but like, GitLab's a supposedly serious place. Don't fucking free trial me.
How dare you free trial me?
It's just like there's a little button in the corner. I can't even remember what it was. And it's just like, oh, try a free trial of something. And I'm like, no.
I mean, it's the done thing these days. YouTube does it. I said that like that was the beginning of a list, but I couldn't think of anything else. But they all, you know,
Amazon does
obviously
it with the
Discord certainly
Prime.
does it. Yeah, Amazon does it. Oh, Amazon's a fucker with it. Like when you order, if you don't have Prime, when you order something, it's like the default. It's like, do you want Prime? And the default selection is yes, I want Prime. And then the next page, it's like, you want Prime, don't you? And it's already ticked and just like,
Hate that.
it's
No.
horrible.
No, because the thing is with me, right? The thing about Prime, first and foremost, Amazon evil and everything, but it's the enshittification that really bothers me with Amazon, because it used to be the case that like if the merchant wanted to give you free shipping, you'd get free shipping. But now there's a £5 Amazon tax on every purchase, basically, unless you get Prime, which I feel is.
Yeah, I'm not sure how Prime works behind the scenes because I think it is the mer it, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that like most stuff. I used to order more than I do now because very poor now. But even then, I never ordered a shit ton. But like most of what I ordered was free delivery anyway, and like free fast delivery. It's just the odd thing. It's the odd thing, and it does seem to be the retailer adding the delivery cost. So I assume Amazon just pays that delivery cost for the. For having a subscription, and it probably now it wouldn't save me money. A few years ago, it would have having Prime would have saved me money, but I just hate subscriptions. I think if you're living sort of like in inverted commas like paycheck to paycheck, like subscriptions are scary.
Yes, absolutely. Even with me, this is why it took me so long to get the Freebooters server up and running. Even though DigitalOcean, perfectly reasonably priced.
Yeah, no, it's quite cheap, isn't it? Yeah. I know there's cheaper out there, but if you want cheap and usable for, you know.
I mean, DigitalOcean's the one I'm familiar with. That obviously gives them advantage.
Yeah.
They're not
I've always
prohibitively
liked
expensive.
that stuff, honestly.
Their dashboard's relatively straightforward. I know they're adding more and more bits and pieces like app deployment platforms and stuff like that, when really what I want is just a little server. They've even got some sort of AI thing now where you can just like, I don't know entirely what it is, plug into an API for an AI or something like that. God, that's a few initialisms there, isn't it? But yeah, for the basic stuff, yeah, it's fine. I think I could go down to a I think there is maybe a cheaper tier or something like that. I'm not entirely sure. It's only $6 a month. It's fine, and it's fast and reliable.
Yeah, I've always liked it. I know they're big and like blah blah blah, and there's probably smaller, but I've just found you know what you're getting, and it's easy to use.
And also they've got like, I don't want to start sounding okay. All right, I'll tell you what. Right, let's on at least my page, I think it is at the bottom of my page where I've got my various affiliate links. DigitalOcean's one of them. So if we do actually ever talk anyone around to DigitalOcean, chrisware.wales, check it out. Down the bottom, there's an affiliate link. You help me out with the cost for the freebooter stuff.
Yep. I mean, we should make clear we are very much not sponsored. We
No,
should be
no.
sponsored by DigitalOcean. I think we're upping them a bit.
If like, I mean, I get sponsorship stuff all the time, and most of it's bullshit or probably a scam. But
Yeah.
if DigitalOcean came to me, or even Linode, to be honest, and said, "Look,
Yeah.
we'll give you your free server costs. All you got to do is give us a shout out every podcast," then that might be the one that brings us around, because it's not too high stakes. It's not like a lot of money. It's just like, goods
Yeah.
and services in kind type of thing. It's something we use, and it would be something, it'd be something we use. We'd be more demonstrating it than advertising it, right? I'm assuming Linode is
Yeah,
basically the same.
It's such a weird area, because like, if you know, if something that I genuinely like and use and is reasonably ethical was like, we'll sponsor your blah blah, and like, you don't really have to do anything different, just say you use it and like it, well, that's true. It's like, there's not, obviously nothing wrong with that, but I'd still feel a bit weird.
Well, I mean, it's the thin end of the wedge, not to use a bit of a tired expression, but also it does give them power over you, even a little bit, and it's, you know, people you like, but it is still a measure of power over you. We are completely independent. We can say wild shit like Palestinians are human beings and not have our advertisers pull. Like, it's,
yeah,
you know,
there's a YouTuber I quite like who was very small and has recently got quite big, Retro Bytes. Mm-hmm. And he was like, he was sponsored by PCB Way.
I don't know who that is.
They do, if you design a PCB, they will print it for you and send it to you. So it's like, it's very...
Okay.
It's sort of niche, but big in that niche.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think sponsorships like that, where it's literally just the person saying, we are sponsored by PCB Way, you can get custom PCBs there. Like, when it's that long... That doesn't really bother me. But when they do the full ad read,
yeah,
that takes like several minutes, I know I shouldn't, because this is me falling into a trap. I kind of enjoy it when they do it sarcastically. When it's a completely inappropriate thing, they know it's inappropriate and they do it sarcastically and they're still getting the money, I kind of enjoy that. But I don't know. Whole sponsorship. And like, we're not used to it as British people, because we've got the BBC. I think Americans, like, you watch American game shows from like the 40s and 50s, and it's like, here's the high scores brought to you by Swanson Soap, and stuff like that. And it's like, that's alien to us.
Yeah, it is kind of weird. And also, Ofcom are pretty tight on the advertising channels and stuff. Yeah, I mean, the internet's kind of fucked with us in that way, because Ofcom don't really pull rank on internet advertising. They're not busy putting things like the the Online Safety Act into play and stuff like that. Not actually enforcing laws that we should have. But also, life hack for people who do watch stuff on YouTube. L is a key on the keyboard you can press, and it fast forwards you 10 minutes. So whenever there is an ad read on a YouTube video, I just go LLL. It's usually about 30 seconds for most of them.
To be clear, 10 seconds, not 10 minutes.
Sorry, 10 seconds. Good one.
I mean, kind of obvious from context, but I just thought I'd make that clear.
Yeah. L for leap forward 10 seconds. J for...
volume down.
Yeah. No, J for back 10 seconds. J is for like...
No, H is back 10 seconds. J and K are up and down the volume. It's Vim keys, basically. It's up, down, left, right.
Hang on a minute. Are you sure?
I'm 92% sure.
I don't want to try it out, because I don't want to risk fucking up my setup. But, okay. Well, I mean, the trouble is, it's like, obviously after this podcast is going to be finished recording, we're going to find out and we will all know the truth. In fact, people
listening
to this...
One of us will be wrong. Yeah. One of us will be right.
Because, no, K is pause and stop. J is back.
I'm going to open. I need to do it in Firefox, because I use Qt browser, and it's all the keys do different things in Qt browser. Obviously.
I've moved browser.
Let's have a look.
I'm on.
You what, sorry?
I've moved over to LibreWolf.
Yeah, I couldn't use LibreWolf. It just doesn't work on a lot of sites.
Well, that was what.
Yeah, hang on. Oh, the touch. Play that quiet. Okay. H. Oh, H does not go back. Yeah, okay. J. J does go back. Oh, my God. K. Okay. Wait, what? Have they changed this?
No, it's always been that way for at least 5 years.
Does it behave differently in Qt browser because of the key bindings or something? Fuck's sake.
Oh, yeah, probably. Qt browser probably does something like that. Oh, yeah, because the arrow keys, you're thinking, so HJKL, they're mapped to arrow keys. Up and down on the arrow keys do the volume. Left and right on the arrow keys go back and forward, I think, 5 seconds.
But can you write down an equation for it?
Hang on. Okay. So in Qt browser, H goes back, L goes forwards in time. J is down volume and K is up volume. I thought that was YouTube bindings. That's better bindings. Why don't YouTube use that?
Because they're better bindings for like tech literate people.
Well, no, they're better for everybody, because H is on the... I mean, regardless of how you look at it, H is on the left, L is on the right.
I mean, J is on the left, L is on the right.
Why is K pause when spaces pause?
Because I don't know. Why have you got me defending YouTube?
Defending YouTube. Oh, I want to talk about Cube Browser very briefly.
Okay, yeah.
So Cube Browser is a keyboard-centric web browser. It's really good. It's, I've talked about it before. Its main sticking point is it doesn't have cosmetic or ad blocking, which only really bothers me on YouTube, but I use a user script which just skips past the ads. It mutes them and skips past them. Okay, so that out of the way. Cube Browser was crashing the other day, like every minute or so. Like it was really badly crashing. So I switched back to Firefox temporarily and I sent a bug report. It's an automated, it's just a thing that pops up when it crashes. Do you want to send a bug report? And I filled in the stuff and I sent the bug report. And it was in the evening and I was like, fuck's sake, I'm going to have to use Firefox now. And I like, Firefox is horrible when you've been using Cube Browser for a while. Absolutely just, it feels archaic. And then woke up the next morning to an email from the developer saying, oh yeah, this seems to be a bug in the recent version of Qt. Here's a link to the bug thread and here's a workaround. And then the next day, he released another version which fixed the bug or worked around the bug by default. Bravo. He's like, that's amazing. That's how software should be. Like, it should be small enough that that's the norm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not doing too bad on the LibreWolf. It doesn't seem to break as much as it used to. The reason that I switched over, because I do quite like the UI of Firefox, and I'm very used to it. But it's that Firefox, they keep putting in more and more machine learning stuff. And they keep and I just wanted a browser that just didn't have that. And LibreWolf at least disables it, you know, properly by default. Like it's the defaults that really have pushed me from one to the other. So everything is kind of prudent, and then you opt into all the extra stuff. And
I think it's fine. LibreWolf is fine, but I think I've said this before. But I'm wary of using projects that are dependent on their host project. That is some, like, I don't like Firefox now. I don't like the AI stuff they're doing. They've kind of proven themselves to be a bad actor or whatever. Now they're not good. They're not trustworthy. And if the Firefox project disappears, then LibreWolf disappears. They are dependent.
Yes.
Or has to massively restructure.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, it's not really. In reality, Qt Browser is dependent on Chromium. Qt Web Engine is just Chromium, really. So, yeah.
We're in one boat or the other, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, you can't live your life on Dillo, really. Because the vast majority of things I use a browser for are web apps now, really.
Yeah. Which is the problem with the web. It shouldn't be an application hosting platform. It's horrible.
Yeah. Well, you say that, but when I want any kind of GUI-ness for a bash script, my instinct is to throw it into a browser window.
A bash script? What do you mean?
So if I want to output something in a bash script, but I don't want to output it to the command line, I want to output it to a GUI, I'll throw it into an HTML file and put it in the browser.
I don't know, explain better.
All right. So if I want to show something like images or something like that in a particular format, right? If I want rich text, for example, rather than opening it in a like an X message window or something like that, I have put it in a HTML file before.
I don't understand what you put a bash script in an HTML file?
No, the output of a bash script into an HTML file.
Oh, you just write HTML from the bash script.
Yeah, that's it.
That's not a web app. That's fine. The web app is when the browser is doing the logic.
Yeah,
which is why something straightforward, like I don't know, I can't think of one song, but like whatever web app you want to think about requires essentially like a 2 gigabyte hosting platform, which is absurd. For, you know, if that was a native application, it would not be using the resources that a browser's use. Browsers are incredibly heavyweight because they have to sort of, because we're doing everything in the least efficient way possible.
Yeah,
I boosted a tweet I think yesterday when because you know RAM prices are skyrocketing because of AI and Crucial have pulled out of that market for consumers. They're just going to service the AI market now.
And the boost.
Well, yeah. That's burning a bridge, because if they come when AI collapses and they come back to the consumer market, I'm not buying their shit anymore. Fuck them. But yeah, it was somebody, because it's been a sort of mantra for decades. Like RAM is cheap, Like, it's okay for applications to use a lot of RAM because RAM is cheap. Well, that's not the fucking case anymore, is it?
No.
Now we've got, you know.
Well, was it like that time back in, I want to say like the 90s or something now, where that Japanese factory burnt down and then the price of RAM went up? Am I remembering that?
Was that RAM or was that hard drive? Yeah, and no, I think it was RAM, wasn't it? I think it was somewhere in East Asia.
Because I remember for a while, RAM was really expensive.
Yeah. God, I've forgotten about that, yeah.
It does come around. Yeah. But then graphics cards went through the roof of crypto. It's like...
Yeah. But the idea that, like, oh, we can design badly because RAM is cheap, it was a stupid... The problem with it is it's a stupid idea even when RAM was cheap. Like, still make your things as efficient as you can.
Yeah.
No, but like, and web apps is literally the least efficient way to do any of this. It's horrible. Like browsers are now virtually, I mean, this is, you know, very trite to say, but like the browser is the OS to a large extent on most operating systems. And all your applications are hosted in this browser engine, which is really like, you know, applications written in JavaScript. Like, there's a place for that, but like, it's so ugly.
Yeah. I think even. I'm sure most people probably feel the same way, but there's a bigger disruption to my workflow moving from one browser to another than it is from moving to Debian to Arch.
Yeah.
And I'd imagine to a lot of extent, if you had a very web-centric workflow from...
I thought I'd have to move to Firefox for a bit because Qt browser was having that bug, like I thought maybe this will take weeks or months to fix. And I was devastated to have to go back to Firefox. It's horrible because you do so much in a browser.
Yeah. I do have. Well, interestingly enough, Qt is my browser that I use when something doesn't work on Firefox, because it.
Qt browser.
Yeah, Qt browser. Qt browser is my is my Chrome alternative. So if something I've got a user agent switcher, and a lot of the times that actually just helps, like just the browser telling the server, "Oh, I'm actually Chrome." You know, I've got my Chrome hat on and my Chrome trench coat
pants.
Yeah, it's just so that works a lot of the time, but sometimes when I do need to go to Chrome, then I'll drop into Qt browser. I do kind of like it. The only thing about Qt browser that is keeping me off it is that it doesn't have any way to like autofill passwords. I actually kind of really like the password manager in Firefox.
I think it does with pass. It does.
How does that work? Do you need a plugin or something?
It comes with a default plugin. You don't need to install anything. Let me see if it's. I think it's in the config directory.
Okay. I mean, I could move over to Pass if I. Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about changing from the KeePass database to keep all my files in, but it is supported relatively broadly, and it is easy to move the file around. Like you've got.
I think there are user scripts for KeePass as well to do it.
I could imagine that actually. I mean, I could probably just search the AUR, not the AUR, the just the Pac-Man thing.
But do you run your browser forgetful? Like when you close it, it forgets all your logins and stuff, and you re-log in? Or
no, not really. I have done in the past, but not at this point in time.
Yeah, even for the password fill stuff, like I'm. Like for the first day of using a new browser, like I'm filling in all my passwords. But after that, everything stays logged in forever now anyway. So it doesn't really, I don't think the lack of password fill would really bother me. I'm fine copying and pasting, you know, the once every 3 months I have to actually log into something.
Oh, okay. Yeah. If it does that, I thought it logged you out every time.
No.
Okay. Postio logs you out quite a lot. Which is why I find it quite handy for Postio. But I could just use...
Right, yeah.
I've got a client set up for that, AERC, which is quite nice. So I could just use that. It's just, to be honest, having Postio was just a little tab in my browser, because Postio and Roundcube and their setup is very low system resources, even for a web app.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It is kind of useful just to have it as an extra tab that's always there rather than an extra terminal window, which I lose or...
I mean, you could just... excuse me.
God bless you.
You don't need your mail client to be the thing that checks for mail. Mine doesn't. I've just got a script that runs every 5 seconds and checks for mail and does a notification if I got new mail, and then I go to my mail client.
That My phone can sort of act as that, but the thing is, I forget.
Like, you can see the notification.
Yeah, I want it to be staring me in the face a little bit more.
Well, mine. To be fair, mine. If the message remains unread, it will notify again. In I think I've got it set to 10 minutes.
Oh, okay. Also, looking for Pass plugins and stuff, I've just noticed there's a package called Rofi Pass, which handles Pass storages in a convenient way. I'm assuming using Rofi.
Yeah.
Which is kind of nice. Also, there's a brute force password cracker for RAR 7-zip and zip archives.
Nice.
Yeah. I love the Arch repos and stuff. It's you get all sorts of wonderful stuff in there.
It's a bit like olden days Linux. If you remember, like Linux in when I started using Linux, like 99, 2000, when you would get like your 8 SUSE CDs or whatever. And then you'd just be poking through. What's this software? What's this do? What's it? Because they would install everything.
Yeah, I basically learned how to play blackjack from like pre-installed. like GNOME games or whatever it was. So anyway, we've been busy, right? That's how we opened up the podcast.
Yeah, you in particular have been very busy with your bash scripting and your website making.
Yes, so I encourage everyone to go. I mean, if you're listening to this, you're almost certainly on freebooters.uk. But if not, go to it, because what have I done with it recently? So I've done a whole bunch of stuff, right? So first of all, the podcast is on the page, right? That's good. And we sort of both worked on Plock, which is now pretty much running good. It took me a while. The big sticking point for me, because I'm a big fan of the .opus files for sound, but .mp3 is by far and away the most cross compatible. Like, Opus is great. You can really shrink the files down to a listenable quality.
I'm wondering whether, because you mentioned a device, was it a TV or something that only accepts MP3s or else, maybe?
No. So our bedroom TV, me and Rosie's bedroom TV, plays MP3s and Opus files, I think. But then,
right.
But then there are other devices that play MP3s and OGGs, but not Opus.
I would imagine that's a front end thing, like, because these things are undoubtedly badly coded, because they've got to be using like FFmpeg in the background. Because why wouldn't they be, right?
Yeah.
And I bet there's just something in the sort of front end code that's just checking the file name. I bet if it's an Opus renamed to MP3, I bet it would. I'm by no means certain, but I think there's a decent shot that it would just play it. So if you just do Opus files renamed to MP3, I know that's improper in some way, but it's improper on shitty operating systems.
Oh, wait a minute,
systems,
no, like, Opus. There is one fundamental difference, because this was a sticking point on Plock for ages, which is where the metadata is kept. So, in MP3s and OGGs, the metadata is kept in the... Oh, God, I can't even forget, or I can't remember the technical names. It's kept in one place, where you'd expect it. But in .opus, it's kept on, like, stream zero.
Right.
So, like, I don't know, like, audio's on stream one, video's on stream two, something like that.
Right.
So it is weirdly awkward to... So basically, in Plock, you have to ascertain where the metadata is kept and then extract the metadata based on the file, which kind of relies... So what I've done, and this is a bit slower than I'd like, but it is the cleanest way I've found, is you will look for it in where it would expect to find it in MP3 and OGG, and then, if it can't find anything there, go into the Opus one. I did have it the other way around, but because most files aren't Opus, it was longer for most files. So I did it. So if it finds something, then it moves on. And you're running FF probe twice if it's an Opus file. Mm. So it takes twice as long, because that's the bulk of the processing time, which doesn't take long. But then when you've got a whole stack of files that you're working through, it adds some time, like probably not enough to like.
I mean, Blop is coded a lot like Blop, and Blop is very dumb It doesn't. When you I mean, as you discovered the other day, when you regenerate your blog, it deletes everything and regenerates everything. It doesn't go, does this file exist? Don't bother creating it. And like you can get for Plock, given that there's a bit more processing, maybe you can make it a bit smarter. Like if this file's already there, don't redo it. Kind of code.
Well, the big difference.
It's much easier to just delete and regenerate, but yeah.
Well, the thing is, well, yeah, but delete and regenerate, yeah, I mean, you'd have to check against, I don't know, modification dates and or something like that, or file sizes, or some sort of hash or something.
You can hash things, but then you've got to store the hash somewhere for next time and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so it is
why I don't bother.
Yeah, and also, like, sometimes, you know, it depends a lot on the change. If you're just changing the header, you do have to generate the whole site again. So,
yeah.
But with Plock, the only files it's actually creating is like the index file, I think, and the RSS file. So because it doesn't manipulate, draws from the media files. They stay the same regardless. I did so many changes to Plock. So like,
really, you'd have to save the data somewhere, and then you're getting into like generating it from like you've got a secondary step, which I wouldn't want to go down that route. I think honestly, I would just lean. I would really just lean for maximum for this stuff. Just lean to maximum compatibility and make it all MP3. I know Opuses are better and small. How much smaller is an Opus? You know, for one of our things, like how much smaller is an Opus?
A surprising amount, really. It depends. So MP3s have changed a lot over the years in terms of how they sound at low bit rates. But it used to be the case that MP3 would sound absolutely god inaudible if it dropped below that sort of threshold of bitrate. Whereas .opus, if you drop the bitrate really low, even though the quality clearly drops, it sounds more pleasing to the ear.
Because they've tuned it really hard for voice, haven't they? That's the point of Opus.
Yeah, and it sounds almost a little bit like, you know, fuzzy radio signal. Like, it's just like...
Yeah, yeah.
So, however, I think MP3s are better in this regard now. That being said, you could easily cut the file size in half, probably more.
Okay, it is significant.
It is significant.
I mean, it's significant, but now we've gone pure audio. It's not like they're that big. What are they?
Are you saying hard disks are cheap? Hard.
Fair point. Yeah.
So the way I've rationalized it in my head... So I did originally do a hard fork and called it Plopus, which was designed to specifically handle Opus files because I kept getting in a muddle about this particular, like, working out which file was which and what to do with each one. And so I just said, I'll do a hard fork. I'll do one fork for Opus and one for MP3. Yeah. And Plopus's job with Opuses was a little bit different. It didn't have the embedded player. It had more of a Gemini kind of look because it was sort of the idea behind it was that it was maybe more of an archival kind of system. Yeah. So that's what I did so I took Space Virgins and I took the audio from that. And then I shrunk it down in .opus files because I could get that basically to a gigabyte for the whole show. And then put that into more of an archival format because, you know, you could, there's nothing to stop you actually watching Space Virgins on the on PeerTube itself. It was really more just for, you know, the purposes of archiving.
Because I
really liked doing Space Virgins. I had a great time with it, and I think we did a good show. And I think the fact that it ended nicely instead of fading out was also something. Not many things I do online actually end gracefully. So it's kind of nice that. So I wanted to keep a little memento of it that's self-hosted.
I just had a look on Freebird. Like, they are currently MP3s.
Yes. So
you have one for go on.
Oh, so Space Virgins is Opus files, but Freebooters is .mp3s because with Freebooters, because they're current, they're new, they're generating. You know, they're not archived. They're not. You know, there's only really one place you can get the Freebooter MP3. I wanted them to be as compatible as possible, and I'm hoping that they're a decent quality. I'm still working on the audio sort of technical gubbins, or I find audio quite hard. Maybe I need a better set of headphones or something. Especially when it comes to compressing.
Well, it's just a lot of it's like audio quality stuff is such an it's such an expertise area that I have no expertise in, and I'm not remotely interested in. I just want to push a button and have the thing pop out. You know, I don't care.
Yeah, and doing it for one voice is easy. You got, but like with me and Drew, for example, I've got to try and get us ideally recording at approximately the same volumes. However, Discord compresses your you know your audio feed.
Yeah.
So mine is less compressed, which basically means I sound more here than you, and you sound more like you're coming through a Discord. And so then I can compress it, but then you sound extra compressed, and then I sound a little bit compressed. But then the volumes are more listenable. Right. It is a bit tricky. If anyone has tips or ideas, I would always be receptive to feedback on.
I mean, and June and Hamish are the two that immediately leap to mind in terms of knowing what the fuck audio is.
Yeah, yeah, we should probably consult them more on that kind of thing. But I know Hamish would say get a proper microphone for one. That would be the first thing that he'd say. Which I actually switched up my microphones lately. I'm on the Yeti at the moment, and you're on the Blue Snowball.
I'm on the cheapo. I'm on the Povo version. Povo.
Yeah, I kind of... because this is a condenser microphone, so this picks up a lot more of like breathing and ticking and, you know, all the stuff in the area. Like I'm in a study right now, and I've got pretty good control over my surroundings, but it's a lot of hard walls, so I don't know. I'm expecting a little bit of reverb here. I don't know.
It sounds quite warm to my ears, to my unthingy ears. You sound quite warm. You don't sound like you're in a hard room.
Okay, well, we've got a decent amount of furniture. We've broken it up. It used to definitely sound harder. Quite close to the mic. So I'm hoping we're getting better with that. But I quite like my voice in a very vain kind of way through a condenser microphone. But things like dynamic microphones, so like what you've got, the Snowball, and like what I used to use, I think it's called a Pro Sound, which I really quite like. I don't like how they sound as much, but they do sound better for how we use them. Like I think they're more like slightly more idiot proof, slightly better for amateurs that don't quite know what they're doing.
I mean, yeah, same. Anything sound, I just want to plug it in and not have to do. I don't want to have to make any decisions because I don't understand the implications. I just want to plug it in and it'd be okay.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same, really. I don't want to have like the little soundboards on your desk that Hamish has got. Like Hamish's setup is quite advanced from what it looks like to me. I'm sure Hamish would be like, oh no, it's very simple, very simple. But no, it's lots of wires.
I mean, he sounds great, but I'm not willing to. There's things I care about and there's things I don't care about on audio. It's a lot like I do not have audiophile ears. It all sounds the same to me.
I've got rubbish headphones. I like them. They're loud. They're just not good.
I got nice, like cheap, but because I was looking for earphones, as you know, because of the echo, you know, cancellation and stuff. And I googled, and it's like you can get from like if you go Chinese, you can get like for £20, you can get IEMs as they call them, in-ear monitors that are of the quality of like pairs that 5 years ago cost £300.
Okay.
So I got some of them, and to me they sound horrible and tinny and very like bright and cold. Because I'm used to consumer level audio that is overdriven, bassy, like excessively warm. But when I'm like watching a film or something, that's when I want I want the really heavy bass. I want it almost like distorted. So I've got and then they broke because I stepped on them. So I got some other ones that are warmer, and like all the audio files were like, oh, they're really good quality, but they're too warm, like they're ridiculously warm, like they're ridiculously bass. And to me, they still sound very, very cold. So I'm used to, you know, like Sony Walkman headphones. That's what I want. It's like,
I mean, I'd be interested on feedback on this one, because the trouble is when we all have like very specific relationships with the sound of our own voice. Some hate it, some love it, some just, you know, and no one really knows how they sound that much unless they listen to themselves a lot. And so
I like, it doesn't particularly embarrass me, or it is embarrassing, but When I listen to myself, but like in my head, I sound like a normal person when I'm talking.
Yeah.
When I listen to myself back, I sound like a fucking cartoon dog. Like, oh, who? Like, absurd.
You've got a great radio voice. It's, I've always thought that, like from the first time I heard you on X Penguin, or so, I think it was, or something.
Something Steve said once is I sound like one of those. I sound like the kind of northerners they have on Radio 4.
The kind of northerners they have on Radio 4.
Yeah. Like if they're talking about like films or art or something, they'll have like a token northerner who's like, yeah, and I've got that kind of vibe. And I was quite complimented by that. I like that.
Okay. All right. I'm not entirely... it's been a while since I listened to Radio 4. It's one of the better ones, but I can't... I think one of my least favourite pieces of music ever made was the Archers theme tune, and I just don't listen to Radio 4.
Oh, God, anymore. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Well, Radio 4 is a weird mix of like sort of news and current affairs programming, and then like the highbrow arty stuff, you know, arts discussions and that kind of thing, and fucking radio soap operas. Yeah. It's such a weird mix.
Yeah, it's.
I think Radio 3 is the actual, like Radio 4, I would say Radio 4 is the bougie one, like the kind of old school bourgeois. Those kind of sensibilities, and then Radio 3 is the truly avant-garde one.
Oh,
like
yeah.
You tune into Radio 3 and you'll get like 18 hours of cafe background music overlaid with like elephant song or something. It's just nonsense and I love it.
Well, Radio 3 I often has a lot of like opera and choral music.
And they're the classical one, but they'll put like really fucking avant-garde stuff on sometimes.
Oh yeah, like it's a bit too avant-garde for me in a lot of cases. I like Classic FM, but the adverts, there's so many fucking adverts on Classic FM.
Classic FM is very like popular classical, it's what you want most of the time. You know, we're not, you know,
it's a lot. But
ads, especially on radio.
Yeah,
like on TV. I always felt like, you know, when you watch ITV or whatever back in the day, like you just go and make a cup of tea or go for a piss, and when you come back, the ads are done, right? But with radio, it's more intrusive somehow.
Because usually you listen to it in the car and you can't get away.
Maybe that, yeah.
It's the adverts absolutely put me off. Oh my god, there was one time on Radio 3 they had fucking avant-garde fucking improv jazz, and it, oh my god, it was so bad. Like, is this, you know, when you say, like, Picasso said, well, it took me so many years to learn how to paint like a master, but lifetime to paint as a child. Like, is it that?
Yes. You've got to spend a lifetime learning the rules so that you know how to break the rules and still have something that makes sense. I don't find it like the real like top end avant-garde, like being as pretentious as it can possibly be kind of jazz. I think for me it's like people who are uneducated in art and they just want to look at something pretty and they think that's what art is, and I think that's where I am with, I just want it to sound nice, like whatever else it does, it can be clever, it can be whatever, but if it doesn't sound nice, I find it very hard to listen to. I like Schoenberg and stuff. So
I like it when visual art does that. But music, I've just also I went to the Tate in St. Ives, which I really, really enjoyed, but they had one exhibition which was a video art piece, which I didn't quite understand, but I can't help but, like, you know, my 5-year-old could do that part of me just came out. And maybe it's because, you know, having done YouTube for this little, like, I know avant-garde video because that's all I've ever done, right?
Like, yeah.
And it's like, it just had, it goes, I walk through, I see the buildings. It does this stuff where it's like, I don't know what they're trying. Like, I really didn't know what they were trying to do. Like, I felt like they were trying to do something different, but it just didn't seem. It just seemed like someone that didn't quite know how to make a film.
I end up arguing both sides of this, but I do think art is worthwhile. I do think fine art is a very worthwhile endeavor, but I do think The top end, I mean, first of all, it's entirely captured by capital. Like it is just it's an investment thing for rich people, and it not and I don't just mean that in the sort of knee-jerk cynical way. Like when you are at university doing art, you kind of get scouted, and you don't really get scouted for your ability, you get scouted for your marketability. So it is completely that now. So that's one part of it. And I do think modern art has been in a crisis since Duchamp made his urinal, the fountain. Because as
When
soon as
was
you ask,
that?
like 1910, somewhere around there. And I do believe that 99% of modern art, if you want, and it's not that's not the right term, but especially like the conceptual, the installation stuff, is bollocks. It is absolute bollocks. It's Emperor's New Clothes. It's at the very best, you get like a visual pun. Like that's what's considered clever art now, is it just makes some kind of like visual pun. And that's sad that essentially the top end of fine art is in the same place as like funny greetings cards.
Now you say fine art, you're talking about like not
Gallery
what?
art.
I mean, when I went to St. Ives, there was like a lot of old stuff, right?
Especially in St. Ives, you'll get a lot of modern artists who have a very traditional practice, because the St. Ives school was very much that. They were almost like a retro. They've always kind of been like a school that's rejected the excesses of modernity. So you get a lot of like very nice landscape stuff and stuff like that. So I think the St. Ives Tate is the better one if you just want to see stuff that is recognisably art.
There was something. It was at the Newlyn Gallery on the way. Like in I want to say like around Penzance. And they had an
The Newlyn
exhibition.
School was the big thing.
And when I went there, the actual main gallery was closed, but they had a breakout gallery by someone called Elizabeth Loveday. And I really enjoyed it. She had a, like, each painting in his collection was a separate interpretation of like the towns around Penzance. So you had like Newlyn, you had Mousel, you had I can't remember now. Let's see. Right, well, it's no. Right, I got. I can link it to you in Discord. They don't have which one's which, and I actually really quite enjoyed them. But that was quite. I quite enjoyed that little gallery. I don't know what we're going to do for our audio listeners. Elizabeth Loveday. Her name's spelt the way that it sounds.
Elizabeth Loveday, and Loveday is one word, obviously. I mean, they're very they. My one problem with art, like this art could have been done any time between like 1920-ish and now. It's not situated in a time. It's a bit floating.
A bit float.
But
How
then,
is that important?
well, I mean, yeah, I mean, this gets a bit deep. But essentially, like fine art should be thought of as like research science, like the top end of science. Like, so it's not science. You're not just trying to reproduce anything. You're trying to come up with new stuff, building on what has happened in the past. You're building on the knowledge of the past to create something new, right? To find something new. This is not doing that. So why is this fine art rather than just illustration?
I mean,
And
from
that's a complicated
my
question.
uneducated point of view, I don't know, but that doesn't affect the enjoyment of it, right?
No, the enjoyment of it is irrelevant.
So
And
that's
I don't care about the enjoyment of it. In the same way that if you read one scientific paper, you read another one, you're going to enjoy one more than the other, but who gives a shit whether you enjoy it or not? That's not the point.
Well, isn't art, I mean, to what point is art for enjoyment? Isn't that a good
Well,
reason?
this is when I will argue two completely different sides, because I very firmly believe that, but I also very firmly disagree with that. And I think the constructivists are right, Like, galleries are oppressive. Galleries should not exist. Art should be woven into life. It shouldn't be abstracted out and put in these special buildings where we go and worship it. Art should be part of life, and that was their whole thing, and I entirely agree with that as well.
Yeah, no,
it should be for making our living spaces more special, more beautiful.
Yeah.
And especially public spaces.
So what about, like, if you were to decorate your living space, most of the stuff that most people would decorate it with would be probably quite mass produced, right?
Mm.
How does that affect its value? And when I say value, I don't mean value in terms of money. I mean value as in its value as art and as what it's trying to do, because it's trying
Yeah, I don't know. Because, again, I've got two completely polar opposite beliefs about that. On the one hand, I don't think it matters whatsoever. Hmm. Its point is not to be enjoyed. If we're thinking of fine art as like research science, then its point is not to be enjoyed. Its point is to advance the field. And it being enjoyed, you know, because, like, again, research science, you know, you come up with a new scientific principle that's building on the past, and you've genuinely thought of something new, and then that can have applications. You know, there can be new inventions that make all our lives better. And for me, that's like that's what fine art is. It's the research end of art.
Yeah,
whether it's enjoyed or not, it's being enjoyed is a nice byproduct. It's not the point. But then again, I also agree with the I also agree with the constructivist that its whole purpose is to make life better. And, like, so I don't know where I hold both views at the same time.
I mean, we do that with all kinds of things as human beings. That's kind of how we work. Mm. We're not robots. I remember there being a story I covered at the paper where a painting was going to be sold to a private collection, and my MP actually stepped in and managed to procure it for the National Gallery of Wales. And
that's good. Yeah,
it is. It's one of the good things he did. He was a Tory and probably very disagreeable, if I'm completely honest. But you know, he did this.
Yeah,
good thing.
I mean, a small key C conservative is going to be, you know, that's it. Preserving art and our cultural history is important to them.
Yeah,
that's conservatism being good.
Yeah. And I mean, this painting was not much, right? Like, it was basically, it had people like in puritanical Welsh dress. I don't even know if I'm using the term puritanical. You know what I mean? Like the black and white, very modest dress. And they were in a church, and it's a very boring painting. But the reason it's historically significant is because it was one of the first like mass produced pieces of art in Wales. You could acquire a copy of this art by... it was something like collecting enough lids of coffee tins or something like that. Like, it was...
There was
some kind of, like, you know, it was one of the first ones of those schemes in Wales where you bought enough of this product, like stamp books or whatever, and you would get this piece of art. And as a result of this, this art was one of the most commonly held pieces, you know, because it was kind of like at the beginning of, like, the printing press or that kind of, you know, not the beginning of the printing press, but the beginning of, like... when stuff started to become you know, manufactured for regular folks. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was one of the first paintings in Wales that would appear in a lot of homes. So it was the original of this that was procured because of its historical significance rather than anything else. But does that make it, I mean, what does that make it into from an artistic point of view? Because from a historical point of view, it's interesting because it represents a turning point in life, you know, in people's lives.
Yeah.
Even like if you want to look at it from a perspective of working class history, this was art coming into the homes of working class people, which was quite a you know, a significant moment in history.
The democratization of art.
But the painting itself was shite. Like, so.
I think that's okay. I don't really know what to say. I was going to go back to the thing about if I was decorating my room, because I hate having art on the walls. I will not have art on the walls. I just, even if it's a piece I like, I will get tired of it so fucking quick. It's like desktop wallpapers. I ended up not having a desktop because I just, within 3 days, I just hate it.
Yeah,
and I don't want to, like, I just want blank walls, honestly.
I like blank desktop backgrounds for sure. I like, I did make a little script. Oh, another thing that I haven't talked about this on the podcast, actually, my art Oh, my art. I did a bit of art, didn't I? This was a while ago. So how does this, how is this, have I showed you my art script?
I don't think so.
So what it does, so I was playing around with image magic for a bit. Right. And what is the script called? Oh, yeah. So I've done a whole bunch of scripts. So I've got one called... I'll need to put these. If you want to, if my code is of interest to anyone, ask me if it's not already up on my Codeberg. Ask me, and I will put it up. So this takes an image. At the moment, you probably need to filter it through a 4F statement or whatever it's called to get it to do on because usually I would put it in a whole directory.
Is this the script where you grab an image? Is it doing the same as the one? It's yeah. Is it grabbing an image from Wikipedia?
No, or are you it's just close. Hang on a minute. It's buggered my code in Discord. It's treated it like it's a spoiler, and it's given it titles. Okay, I should have done that in backticks. So what it does, I couldn't get the thing to pull down from Wikipedia properly. I couldn't find like the API reference or whatever it was. So what I did instead was
always give up on using APIs, just scrape.
I might have come across a little message somewhere that said, please don't scrape it using Wikipedia, we are trying so hard.
Make your APIs better then.
So anyway, what I did is like it roots around in my, what folder does it do? Oh, it doesn't. So basically, I make this so that it works in a folder, and it takes all of the images in a folder, it crops them down to a 720 by 720 square, applies a bunch of effects, takes a random word from the dictionary, and then puts it as like an album title.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically, it takes all my random like photos, and it turns them into album covers.
Which is great.
And the thing is, it only makes sense like 1 out of 100 times. You've got to run it en masse for the right word and the right thing to come up. But also, like, is a similar one, but this one's more aesthetic, is I can't even remember. I got to name my things better. I can't even remember it now. Anyway, basically, it's the script. I've lost it. And it takes another random photo from my images, squishes it into a 1080 by or a 1920 by 1080 resolution, blurs the hell out of it, massively ups the saturation, takes a random word from an English dictionary, puts it in a random color, gives it a random text effect, and then just throws it up. So you've got this random mess.
Yeah.
With a random word in a random color, and I can press a shortcut key on my keyboard and it regenerates. Doom, 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 doom.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't remember where the files go. I think it goes in my dot cache, which I clear every reboot. So I can pull them out of the cache if one is good, but for the most part, they're worthless. So does that have any value whatsoever as art?
Well, I mean, that's kind of the thing. This gets into where fine art went after Duchamp. What the thing is, like, anything can be art. You've just got to argue that it is. And that's where the art really now is in the bullshitting that this is art for these
reasons. Okay, all right. Let me accompany it with some bullshit, right? So basically, what this, the question that this is trying to sort of pose slash answer slash sort of chew over is, this particular art removes agency from the artist, right? It's taken images that were never designed for this purpose, so they might as they're nearly random. It then applies a set number of filters. I'm talking more about the one that turns it into an album. It uses random words placed in a random position on the album cover. So a lot of this album is it's basically random, with the exception some of the filters to make it look album covery, and that it's square. So
yeah.
So it's sort of like art, but I'm less involved in it than if I actually made it. Like
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So
it's a
in
bit
terms of
like it's like a bit of Jackson
that,
Pollock, you know? Like I'm kind of throwing stuff at a canvas.
No. Pollock is not a good. You shouldn't say that.
As in Pollock's
But
not good
if
or
we,
Pollock's too good for me.
no, it's not a good comparison because
Okay.
Pollock is not random at all.
Right, okay.
It's the opposite of that. Pollock is very controlled. There is some random because he's using spatter, so there's some randomness, but he's using the point is that the randomness weaves into a very cohesive kind of rhythm and structure. I mean, it's so if we were on a fine art degree, I'm your tutor, you are the art student, I would say that's interesting, but it's been done, that's passé, that's been done before, that question has been asked before. Like you're kind of in the field of generative art, which is an offshoot that is interesting in its own right, but is not fashionable right now.
Okay.
So you can pursue that, but try and find something a bit more current to say with it.
Right, okay. So what so here some more bullshit. Anything can be an album cover.
That's more. That could actually work.
Like I mean
Make it more. Make it more sort of personal and almost like social media-y. Like fine art, this is a few years ago, really, but like fine art went very social media-y. Like you could have a booth. You could have it's literally, you know, a photo booth where you go in and take those strip of photo. Like make the this would be the installation for this. You set one of those up, and people go in and take photos, and then it does this to the images and makes an album cover out of there. It makes a personalized album cover for them, and then it comes out of a little thing, and they take it home with them.
Yeah, that's the art, the
You could wrap enough bullshit around that because you've got to have the physical impressive thing. You got to have like a gimmick. It's got to be this. I mean, this is where I hate it. I hate where fine art has gone. But it's like it's gimmicks. It's really marketing for nothing.
What
It's
about
you know
is the
it's
code itself the art?
no. I think people have tried that, but yeah, that was very sort of like short-lived.
I could print out the code and put it on my wall.
Yeah, I mean, you could certainly wrap bullshit around that and get away with that.
Okay. So some degree
Which
do
is the art? I mean, you could go. So in art history, sort of like Renaissance plus, there's loads of portrait of the artist, right? That's a thing that people do. So and that would often later on they would really like to include like their tools. The tools of their trade in that, so it'd be portrait of the artist, and it'd be like, his mixing table and his palette and all his colors and his easels and his canvases everywhere. So you could call that. So that is your tools. The code is your tool. So you could print out the code, source code, and say portrait of the artist. Call it portrait of the artist, and then you've got the pun. You've got the pun that they love. And it's a little bit clever, and it's basically art has become advertising. Like you want a clever idea, simply stated, that makes people go, oh, and that's all. So it's like an advertisement for nothing. That's fine art at the moment.
But so how important is the fashionability of something? Like, what if I wanted to
Incredibly important, but it's one of those things where if you want to be an artist and make a really good living, you're fashionable. If you want to be the superstar of the moment, you go unfashionable in the right way.
Yeah, like I mean, I obviously I'm not going to become a professional. Like, fuck the money and even fuck the fame. Does that like
Well,
what
I mean,
if?
success in art now is fame and money. If we're talking top tier, like it is less so than it was in like the I think the 90s was the peak of that, with the Damien Hirsts and whatnot. But yeah, it's I mean it's,
But
it is you what
how?
you are being. You're being picked by billionaires to be a good investment, really.
But that's, I mean, that's how, but does is my art less valid if I don't care about that shit?
If you don't care about that shit, you can't, like, that's what art is now. So if you don't care about that shit, you're not doing art because you can't, because you won't have access to it. I mean, you
So
have to
if,
pretend you don't care about that stuff because that's part of being an artist. You don't care about the money. You're just blah, 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 blah. But did you hear about the Damien Hirst thing when the kid stole like a pencil crayon from one of his installations?
no.
So there's Damien Hirst in Slade. And to be clear, Damien Hirst is kind of like Gainsborough. Like he doesn't do the work himself. He has a team of, he comes up with the idea, then he has a team of people that actually make the thing, right? And he had an installation that was kind of like artist studio. It was, you know, portrait of the artist kind of thing. It was his an artist studio, so it was just a room with a bunch of art materials in it. That was the installation. And there was pencil crayons were part of the installation. And this kid, art student, stole one of the pencil crayons and then sent Damien Hirst a ransom note. Because basically, like, if the installation is worth this many millions, then this pencil crayon is worth, like, you know, 50 grand. So he sent him a ransom note for 50 grand to get the pencil crayon back. And Damien Hirst called the police and sued him. So, like, absolute lack of sense of humor, absolute lack of. Because what that what the kid does did was more artistic, was more, a more witty sort of art activity than what Damien Hirst was doing at that point. But Damien Hirst didn't react like, "Oh, that's clever. I enjoyed that." Like, yeah, you've commented on my art in an interesting way. Like, no, it was like, we'll call the police.
So, yeah, but that's something worthy of rebelling against, right?
No, absolutely,
So what, like some street artist who's doing chalk
I
paintings?
garbled that story, by the way. Like, the gist of that is right, but the details are no doubt all wrong, you know. But yeah,
That's
just
right.
for
We'll
anybody
call it
that's
like
ever.
a fable or a parable or something, you know? A
Yeah,
parable.
yeah, yeah.
Like, so, but like, you know, like, you know, you see street artists who just do chalk stuff on the floor, and sometimes it can be really good, and you know, it's very ephemeral, of course, because one rain or you know, an
Yeah.
overnight. That is clearly so, and assuming this person doesn't do it for money or whatever, they're just doing it because they're arty, that's their thing. Does that make it less valid as art then? Are they
Well,
not?
I'll a more extreme version of that. This is a very ancient Buddhist practice. I'm going to post it. Anybody listening who wants to look up Buddhist sand mandala. So that is a Buddhist sand mandala.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So that's made out of individual grains of coloured sand that are placed one by, not necessarily one by one, but like in the places where it matters, one by one. So all those like sort of contours and shading and gradients are all done like by placing like slightly different coloured pieces of sand, grains of sand. So this thing can take potentially like weeks, months to like a few monks will work on this for weeks or months, right?
Months of monks.
And then the months of monks. And then the moment it's complete, they sweep it away. And
That's
that's the point,
hardcore.
you know, it's about the Buddhist, you know, impermanence and lack of attachment and all that kind of stuff. Like it's a commentary on that. And I think that obviously leans into my, because I like ephemeral stuff. And that leans into that. And I love that. I love the idea of creating something this beautiful and then just as soon as it's done, sweeping it away. Because the point, and this was the case for me when I was painting, the point for me was never the finished piece. The point was the process. Like what I learned, what I gained, you know, it was the finished thing was of no value whatsoever to me. I didn't give a fuck about it. It was the journey is what matters for you as the artist.
Yeah, I often feel like that when I've done something, and I'm not the best at completing stuff, and I think this might feed into why, because I enjoy the doing of it, but then sometimes when I've
Yeah.
completed something, I don't know, like I feel like there's an
Well,
emptiness, you know?
you get to a point where I've learned everything I can learn. If I complete this, I won't learn anymore, so I'm done. And I think that's fine.
Actually, interestingly enough, to segue to another topic. I kind of feel a lot like that with YouTube. The like I've been I struggle with this a lot in my head in a very personal way, but I feel that like there is an ephemerality to YouTube which is very easy to want to fight against. So I was looking, so what one thing I was thinking of doing was to make a little podcast archive of all my videos on YouTube. So take all my videos from YouTube, turn them into audio. Maybe get rid of some of the ones that desperately need the visual, and then put them onto the self-hosted website. And then I looked, and I was looking through the videos, and I was thinking, the vast majority of these videos don't make sense anymore. They're about software that has been superseded or out of date. Someone actually messaged me on Master the other day saying that I did a video on dpaste, you know, the pastebin one. So that's gone down now. I don't know what you want to do with your video, but like that's on a squatter's domain. So I don't know. Yeah, like the thing, and also
I mean,
with
I think nerds in general lean towards a conservative attitude, a preservation attitude. Yeah. Like all of this, there's all this cultural output, and it must be preserved. Mm. And they kind of, it's sometimes framed as like they're historians, like we're preserving this for history. And I think that leans into a sort of a postmodern interpretation of history, a way history is taught now, as well as thought about. Mm. Like everything is put in port, but really historically, historically most stuff is not important. It doesn't fucking matter.
A lot of it, for me, is making the work worthwhile. Like if I like those, a lot of those videos, I don't know. Like, would it have mattered if I'd never done them at all? In many ways, I mean, many of them earn me a bit of cash.
I mean, they've brought, you know, they've brought happiness to people. They've brought, you know, I've watched your videos and I've gained enjoyment from them. But I use videos to stave off my mental illness. You know, they literally make my life better.
So yeah,
but that doesn't mean you have to keep them forever.
No, like I always think, what am I trying to capture? And what I, the answer...
Oh, sorry, very briefly, like, just to make something clear. Like, if you personally want to keep these as a record or to look back at or whatever, no problem with that whatsoever. I'm not saying nobody should ever want to hold onto anything ever. That's not my point.
I mean, it all gets burnt up in the sun in the end, right? Like, no, we can take none of this to the grave.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. Yeah, and I think there should be rather than trying to preserve everything and save everything, keep everything, there should be an intentionality to what you do want to keep and what doesn't matter.
Yeah, so I'm learning to let go on YouTube in a lot of ways, and because also not only is the ephemerality in the stuff that I do, but it's also in the algorithm and the platform of YouTube itself, because YouTube's changed a lot over the years, and what it wants to be has changed a lot over the years. At the moment, YouTube wants to be very much like television and short form content. Those are like the two things. Neither of which I'm particularly interested in. Least of all,
it's not what YouTube's good at either, which is sad. Like, YouTube is good at the more niche, the more interesting.
Yeah, I liked the medium length content. I like the video essays and stuff like that. The stuff that's done by regular.
Let me just rephrase what I just said, because I think YouTube really wants YouTube to be mass content.
Yeah.
You know, stuff, a lot of stuff that's for everybody.
Yeah.
But like what YouTube's really good at is the opposite of that. Mm. Like only me and 600 other people are going to find this interesting, but we find it really interesting.
Yeah.
Like that's what YouTube is. That's what the internet, and this applies to the whole internet, like that's what the internet used to be really good at, like it's something tailored just for you. Mm. And now but all the corporations, because they want money, want it to be boring, just TV again, like just stuff that's for everybody but nobody loves.
Yeah, and also there is an element of like they want it to be less human, because like there are, like if I post. Right, so it used to be the case that most of my videos would be watched by non-subscribers, and now most of my videos are watched by subscribers. Which means that YouTube basically these days has no interest in getting my videos out there, and I'm fine with that. Like it's put me in my place. It's said that you're not the ones that we want front and foremost in our organization. Not even front and foremost. We're just like, you're here, but like we're just going to ignore you. And and if I post certain content, like for example, if I post Linux content, distro reviews or something like that, I'll get good views. That's fine. But if I post other stuff, particularly non-techie stuff, it just, you know, there's a number of people that are interested in it, but it's a far smaller proportion of people that will just show up for Linux content. And
well, I think a lot of people would be quite happy with that. They'd be quite happy with, I've got an audience of 10,000-20,000, and all I need to do is make these kind of videos and those people will be happy, and that's a happy relationship. But I think you're a kind of person who wants to grow.
Yeah.
Essentially, you don't want to you want to develop. You want to move on from doing what you're doing now to doing something bigger. Not bigger, like more, but like you sort of, really, you sort of You want to grow as an artist. Like, genuinely.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, and I agree, and you're right. I want to grow in a way that's not corporate approved. And the thing is, I've put a lot of work into YouTube over the years, a lot of work into it, and it's I feel like it draws me back from time to time, but really I know that I want to turn my back on it because it's just not where I am anymore. But then I look at other, like the thing is, it's like, but I'm certainly not an Instagrammer. I'm certainly not a TikToker. I might be a Twitch streamer, but I think the games I play are probably too niche. So what, where do I fit?
I think this touches on a conversation we were sort of having in text earlier, which is me sort of reacting a bit against, like, I've sort of for a while I've taken Federation as like something that's inherently good. But it was really Wing actually who made me think about this, because Wing is on his own website doing just a page of his videos, right? Which is, essentially you kind of YouTube. And my thought really was, like, why does everything always have to be connected together? Why can't Wing just have a, why can't we all just have a page on our website where we have our videos?
What's Wing's webpage? Website?
Feather.onl.
Feather.onl.
Yeah, it's video thing. He's making it at the moment, so it's in a test state at the moment. It's just it's videos of that game that I can never remember the name of, the nice looking game. But yeah, like, why does everything have to be connected to everything? Why? Because it sort of a little bit robs us of the joy of discovery, and also it makes everything it sort of implies that everything has to be for everybody.
Well,
And I think
also,
it
I think
wouldn't,
more
like,
pertinently.
some things being federated is certainly good, but as we were talking about forums, like, I'd sort of like to have like a freebooters forum that is just an old-fashioned web forum that's not federated, not connected to anything. You find out about it by finding out about it, and if you like it, you can post stuff. Like, it doesn't have, not every, again, I'm repeating myself, but not everything has to be connected to everything else.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I particularly feel like that with chat because you look at all of the federated chats, XMPP and Matrix, and they're all, both of those are more difficult than they need to be. When I feel like we cracked that particular puzzle with IRC, which is centralized of sorts, but you get to use your own client. It's IRC works the way it feels like it should work, and there doesn't seem to be like any real problems with it. Like we done it, we fixed it. Like,
Well, it's centralized, and it's not, it's kind of federated, but it's centralized and not federated, but it's centralized. It's the kind of centralization I like, because IRC isn't inherently centralized. It's just that certain servers got better at being servers, so everybody went there.
Oh no.
It's
Like what?
a centralization of convenience, and then, but it, because it's an open protocol, if that server becomes shit, another server will move to another server, and that's what I want, especially with chat stuff.
Well, the thing is, as well, with when it comes to, first of all, you can use your own client, which always makes things a bit easier or a bit more like nicer to use. But when I say centralized, like there are a handful of servers that like it's trivial to go from one server to another, and
Well, we could set up an IRC server. It's not inherently centralized.
exactly. So it's not, but from that point of view, but it does mean if you want to chat on this server, you have to join this server on its conditions. Which is fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's not federated.
Well, I mean, IRC is a good example, actually, compared to, like, actual federated services, because would IRC benefit from every server being connected to every other server?
Well, that's
Honestly, no.
no, because that's XMPP, which it does have its core fan base. Many or some of whom I think listen to us. So shout out. But at the same time, what does XMPP offer that IRC fundamentally doesn't? Maybe something to do with voice and whatever, but like really.
Yeah, but I mean, features is kind of a little bit beside the point, because any of these could, you theoretically have those features. Yeah, it's more like structurally, what does Federation offer? And it's for some, I mean, I like it on Mastodon. I like Federation on Mastodon. I think it makes sense there. But for a forum, I don't like Lemmy. I tried to get along with Lemmy, and I don't like it. I don't need Federation for what is effectively a web forum. I think that makes it worse, honestly.
It depends on
I like having, for a web forum, I like a little secluded community that people can find out about, but it's not there present with everything else.
I'm in one Lemmy Yeah, I kind of, because I the only Lemmy I use is a place called Fedit.uk, which obviously Reddit, but with Federation.
Yeah.
And I quite like it because it's just a British centric Lemmy instance. But really, it's just a forum. Like, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't know, actually. I'm.
I never really found any value in Reddit being the host of many communities. Like, I had like the three that I looked at. And there was no connection between those three. It didn't give me anything that they're all hosting in the same place. The counter to that, I would say, is when you're looking for information, if you're looking for the answer to a very well-defined question, you know, how do you do X in Bash? Reddit is often a very good source of answers. So from that point of view, the centralization is kind of useful. But
do you know what?
That's just a failing of search engines, really.
I'm looking through the posts on Fedit UK, and a lot of the comments on a lot of the posts, including a lot of the posts put up, are in fact from other instances. I'm going to say it looks like that this looks, because I quite like it, I don't really think that much about the underlying stuff behind it. I have a soft spot for British memes. My favorite one at the moment is, because they're doing, of course, the Keir Starmer is trying to roll out like this citizen's ID thing, Brit card thing. Like, it started with Americans making fun of us, and rightfully so, where it's like, you got a license for that? Because, you know, we got, you got a license for that television? You got a license for that knife? You got, you got a license for that you? And that's the meme. Yeah, that's the current meme that I'm kind of enjoying at the moment, like, because it's, yeah. Fedit.uk, I actually really quite like it, but you say the overheads are a lot.
Before we go on to that, because the Federation there, but yeah, okay, so again, on Reddit, using Reddit as an example, like the communities I belong to on Reddit were so large that they weren't really communities. I didn't know anybody. There would be a thing, I would comment on it, other people would respond, but there was no relationship there because there was 100,000 people on that subreddit. You're not going to talk to the same person twice. Fedit.uk being federated and you getting these comments from other places, I think actually dilutes community rather than fermenting community. A small self-contained thing is going to inherently just have more community because there are fewer people. Unless passing train or whatever you want to call it, somebody just fly by making a comment. It might be an interesting comment, but that is, I think, dilutory. Is that a word to community?
Okay, yeah, no, that's completely. If not factually true, really, isn't it? None of these comments on Fedit are friends talking to each other. It's people just giving their opinion on the thing that's been posted.
And I think this is, not everything should be just insular groups of friends talking to each other. Like, there should be things like that, but there also should be things that aren't like that. The overhead, especially of ActivityPub, is huge. Like, just Mastodon is so simple.
Yeah,
but you can't host it on like a bargain basement VPS, which is ridiculous.
Is it the Federation itself that raises that bar? Like, is GoTo Social going to be?
Yeah. No, it's the Federation that is the heavy part. Because the rest is just a text box and you submit text and it writes it to a database. We've been doing that since the 90s, right? Like, that doesn't take much hardware. It's the Federation that is really. And I think it is partly because it's a pushy kind of protocol, isn't it? You receive messages from the broader network. You don't go and ask for the specific data that you want.
Is the optimal way to do the Fediverse, like Mastodon and everything, is the optimal way to do that basically to have a substantial number of like medium-sized servers, so you don't get the over-centralization, but you also don't get the over-fragmentation? Is there like a sweet spot where the resources are kind of pooled, but at the same time there isn't
there's been several times when I've tried to do like my own single user instance on the Fediverse, right? I mean, and when I say the Fediverse, I mean the Twitter like part of the Fediverse. Mastodon for shorthand. Are we okay with calling it Mastodon for shorthand? I know that's just one, but it's even hard to fucking talk about. But yeah, so I've tried to do single user, single instance. And you don't, you just, you cannot possibly get it to properly federate. You are missing comments. You go into a thread, and then if you go to the like the home server of that thread, you're seeing 10 times as many comments. And we've had various people who run on a single user instance who say, that's not the case for me. But the thing is, you don't know what you're not seeing until you check.
Yeah.
Right. And whenever somebody said that, I've said, well, go and check out, look at a big thread, go and check and see if there's more comments. And there always is more comment, far more comments on the home server. So I don't think, yeah, the idea of everybody having their own instances is something I like, but it doesn't work. So I think, essentially that's long form. I'm agreeing with you. I think it works its best when it's lots of medium sized instances talking to each other.
Yeah.
And that's not the interesting version of that.
No.
The interesting version of that is a vast, you know, like huge servers, medium-sized servers, single user, and all working fully. Mm. But you cannot get full experience on a very small server. You just can't.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I was working about, and I'm just a couple of things on my Codeberg that I was sort of like just working out conceptually, was like the idea of like basically, if you can, simplify an RSS to a Twitter-esque kind of protocol. So
yeah, I wouldn't want it to be RSS is XML, which is an ugly, heavy format. Like just something simple and text-based.
Yes,
would be better. But yeah, in principle, yes.
Yeah. So the principle of that
structured, a structured thing. I mean, for the your status.txt type thing, that works perfectly. For something like more like a federated network, you need something a bit more complicated than that. But just APIs that you pull and you just get text back, that could work great. I mean, that would be a different thing from Activity. ActivityPub's good at what it does. Mm. It is just inherently a very heavy thing. And like even in the sort of like the idealized version of we all run our own very small instances that all talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like economies of scale are a thing. So if we're thinking about sort of global resource usage, which I think we should think about to an extent, that is the least efficient way to do it.
As in, sorry,
like it's wasteful of resources.
Yeah. Do you mean completely decentralized?
Just not very. I mean, even if we just talk about electricity.
Yeah.
You know, everybody having their own individual server is the most wasteful way to do that in terms of finite resources.
Possibly, but okay. So let me explain my logic behind status.txt basically is just you put up a text file and then everyone pulls down this text file, arranges it in order of date, and then there you go. So it's completely ephemeral. Only the last status you made matters. You can save statuses that you've pulled before, but fundamentally it's just a text file in a standard format that you pull down, and you can be like busy online. It could be as simple as that. It could be a short blog post or something. It's just something that is a status that you can pull down. But with what did I call it? Something like feed.txt. It's a format of a text file. So I'm still working out the specifics of it. Because time zones are something you've got to think about. I never thought about that in the earlier iterations of it. So I don't know, epoch time kind of might work for that one. So you've got basically, you got one line with three components. You've got epoch time, let's say. You've got a sentence that can act as a status or a post. And then a URL at the end, which is optional. And then you've just got, so one line, one entry, everyone has their TXT file of however many entries they have. And then with something similar to an RSS reader, it just pulls that down and displays them as a status. It is limited by the fact that it's one sentence per status. It's one line per status.
Yeah.
So that's not necessarily a hard character limit or anything like that. It's just whatever fits on one line. And the reason I sort of drift towards that idea is everyone can, you can host that anywhere, right? Like it's the lowest possible barrier of entry to self-hosting. So for example, it could be, you could self-host it on a Git, You know, GitHub, GitLab, Codebook, whatever, just anywhere that you can get a text file. You know, you even Pastebin or something like that. Like, it is so versatile. You can host this one text file anywhere. It's completely decentralized. You know, there is no central server. It's all opt-in. You want to follow someone, you have to put their URL in your reader. You can have like call signs, or you know, like a call sign system, so that if someone wants to mention you, they can, but it's not notifications. Like, the notifications are absent from this, because a lot of social media shouldn't have notifications. Like, it shouldn't be that controlling over our lives. It should be something that you check, like you pick up a newspaper and read the headlines or whatever, or something like that. Like, it shouldn't be. Whenever with all my social media, with the exception of Discord, which I don't know if you count, I turn notifications off. Like, I don't want to be notified when my social media is going off. If I have a moment, I'll look at it. Yeah. But fundamentally, you know, even if I'm mentioned, I don't get a notification. I will just look at it in the, you know, an ad break or something or whatever. So, yeah, it's like, you know, but the thing is as well, is that because the files are so small, because, you know, your average person's only going to be subscribed to things they're actually going to ideally read, then, you know, you're not pulling that many requests from all over the place. But what you could do is, you know, you could clump the feeds.
You could have places that have sort of curated lists and clump them all together and make it into one text file to reduce the number of requests. Like, we could have a freebooters text file that is all of the freebooters people, and it, you know, period, you know, every 5 minutes it clumps it all together into one text file, kind of thing.
Yeah. So it's that's sort of the founding principle of it. Like, so simple, you can do all kinds of stuff with it in that regard. Interestingly enough, actually, one of the other many projects I've been working on, which I think I have showed you, is freebooter.uk, because I had that domain that I wasn't really doing much with. You can get to it from the Freebooters website, which is, and again, I made this with a bash script, an aggregated text blog of, at the moment, it's just me, you, and Ghosty. But if any particular, you know, freebooters people, particularly those in the Discord or something, want to get in on this, just let me know. But providing you're just like, you know, small web, writing your own stuff kind of thing, I don't, you know, you just gotta, you know.
Also about the status thing, I think it's a really cool idea, and I want to be in on that. I think that's a cool thing to do. But it is also a little bit sad that. So Linux still has it, but like there was the Finger protocol, which is not a million miles away from what you're describing. Like, you could set a status and you could finger a user. Yeah, you know, okay, like, yeah. Rude puns aside. you could finger a user and you would get like their their last status was one of the things it could do. So this was a thing that existed on these text-based systems on a particular network, obviously. And like, it's a little bit sad that we're essentially taking a Unix protocol and putting it on the web. Like, everything ends up on the fucking web, and that is the best way to do it. I'm not saying otherwise, but it's sad that is the best way to do it.
I mean, it doesn't everything's have going to be on the web. It can be on Gemini.
Yeah, well, it could, yeah, but again, it's you know, it's same either way, really. You know what I mean? It could be Gemini. It could be Gopher. It could be. I mean, you could pull a text file from FTP. Like, those would all work, but it's like, we have this built-in thing in Unix. It's a shame we can't revive that and make that sort of internet aware, you know?
Yeah. So what does Finger work on if not the internet then? Does it like local area networks or something?
Yeah, local network. I mean, there might be a system like email addresses for doing it across, you know, network boundaries, but I don't know. I mean, I've never really, I'm not super conversant in it or anything, because it was a before my time kind of thing, but there are all these like little Unixy things that already exist. Like, you literally send messages to other people who are on the same system as you.
The
protocol for doing that, like, there are all of these protocols, and everything's been sort of swallowed up by the web, and that's really sad.
Yeah, and so you don't put too much of a distinction between Gemini and the web. You think of Gemini as what, like an incident?
Well, no, you're still trying to, rather than having specific protocols for things, we're still piggybacking on other things just because they can deliver a text file, you know?
Yeah. So this is the ultimate.
I do a lot. I do a ton in the terminal that pulls information from the web, and it's really sad. Like, I'm using this text-based thing to pull text-based information over this delivery system that's now really designed for something very different from that.
So Finger is a protocol that more directly aligns with that. Is it still used?
Yeah. I'm not saying I don't, not that I know of. I mean, there might be some specific use cases for it on specific systems, but because I mean, Unix is designed as a multi-user system, and we all use it as a single user thing now.
Yeah.
Apart from on the web, they're all Unix and broader Unix family. They're all Unix servers, but we're not using them as Unix servers because Windows was the dominant desktop OS for so long. We're using them through this. We're using the web as like a medium for doing things that the base systems on both end can do in a better way, and that's a little bit. It's just a frustration rather than a like I think we should go in that direction kind of thing.
I mean, what's I don't know if you did any. I never followed up when I think you mentioned it, but like, didn't you have like a weren't you working on a BBS or something?
Yeah. You've got an account on that. You should go and have a play with it.
Yeah. I gotta look it up through. I definitely should. I gotta look
And I
it up
mean
through
that
the.
would be an example of a place where anybody could host their text file.
Yeah. So I mean, again, hypothetically, if we set up a new server with like people from freebooters could just log in like SSH and then
Yeah.
message each other with Finger. I was gonna say something slightly
Yeah.
inappropriate. That would be an because like fundamentally then, thanks to SSH, we could all be users on the same local
Yeah.
network slash
Well,
machine.
that would be kind of what I've set up with UWOT. Yeah, we could do that or not. But
UWOT.
the way you describe it, the thing you were describing is more likely to be used because I'm not going to log in. I'm not going to SSH log into another machine to, do the thing, really, realistically.
I've been thinking about getting a separate server just for SSHing in on my phone and just doing phone-based things, but through a
Yeah.
it's yeah I might I don't know it's a bit of extra money, like you say, like subscriptions can be a bit scary sometimes, even though it's reasonably priced. But
Yeah.
like
I mean, could you not do that on the same one?
I could do it on the freebooter server, I guess. I could at least give it a
Yeah.
try. But because freebooters is public facing, I don't want to do anything too
I
secure.
won't worry about that. Like, if it
Is
gets,
it?
you just back up from a store, it's whatever.
Yeah, I suppose so. It could be. Yeah. Have you logged into the freebooters yet?
I haven't. No,
No.
I've been a bit mentally absent lately.
Fair enough. It's good. I've tidied. I mean, if you ever get a chance, do so, because I've added what I've
Yeah, no,
done
I absolutely will. Yeah.
is the freebooters stuff. I'm not super. I'm still learning this with the groups and the permissions, but I've done a freebooters group with freebooters permissions, which you're in. So I hope that like you can access all the VAR WW stuff. And you know, like I
Yeah.
mean,
Yeah.
you've got pseudo privileges as well. So if you can't,
Yeah,
then
yeah, yeah.
and you can fix it yourself, then by all means do so. But
Yeah, when my head is in a bit more of a play with thingsy kind of state, I'll definitely have a poke around there. And you should have a poke around you what?
yeah, definitely. I've also got I've put what you call it, Owncast on it, which I
Yeah.
which is good. That was easy enough to do. Did I get myself wrapped up in it? Because also no, I think that was actually really quite straightforward. So I popped that in. Gemini's on it. At some point, I'll have to make sure that everything I do it on the web is mirrored to Gemini, because that's really easy to do on the same
Yeah.
server. This podcast is mirrored on Gemini, as is the Space Virgins archive, because all you got to do is just I did a bash feed of collating all the posts and stuff, all the files, and then just did a symlink, so you can sort of symlink in, so it's all
You should get Gopher off as well.
it's Gopher
Because I know
hardware.
the No. The Gopher map format for the index file is finicky, but other than that, it's just you just put files wherever. And I know that like the retro computing people really like Gopher because they can't do Gemini because of the SSL stuff.
Which I'm kind of surprised they went with. You know, I don't think Gemini needs
Yeah,
that
I was
purpose.
saying. Yeah, I wish it was. I know it's insecure, but fuck it.
When I say when we say insecure, you just mean that, like, how obviously it's not private, right? Like, if it's not encrypted, it's not private.
Yeah, no, it's not
how,
private. No.
How vulnerable is it to man in the middle attacks, really?
Well, I mean, yeah, if it's completely unencrypted, it is very vulnerable to man in the middle. You know, if somebody hijacks your Wi-Fi, you know, if you're in a public space and somebody's got a spurious Wi-Fi thingy that you connect to, then they can man in the middle of you very easily. But if I'm just reading, like, personal blogs and stuff, like, who gives a shit? What, like, oh, that it seems weird that Chris is promoting fascism today.
Yeah.
I assume I got man in the middle. And then I'll get home and go, oh, yeah, that's the actual, like, who fucking cares?
Oh, Chris has started selling crypto.
Yeah.
I guess. Well, I can give Go for a go. I mean, it's a Debian 13 server. I'm assuming that it's all in the repos or easily acquirable, if not.
I do wish there was Gemini without the SSL certificates.
Yeah,
I
it'd
really
be nice
do.
If it was all, optional or something.
Yeah. I guess if it was optional, no, because it's kind of optional on the web and everybody does it. I think, yeah, I don't know.
It's not, I don't know. I say it's pseudo-optional on the web, really. Like, if you're not running an HTTP encryption, your browser will kick up a fuss and say, oh, this isn't secure.
That's annoying in itself. Yeah, because, again, I think a retro computing person, like, messaged me and said, I like reading your website, but I can't see it on my retro. You know, I like looking at it on my retro. And would you possibly put up, you know, an HTTP version, which is trivial to do in Nginx? So, yeah, I did that. And, yeah, I just think, yeah, I don't know. Unless you're using your credit card, you know, it's not often that I use my credit card on Gemini. It's like, I'm, you know. On a personal, on our static fucking websites, does it really matter? Is having an SSL certificate actually doing anything for us? There's probably security people who are like yelling at us. Yes, it fucking does. But
I'd like to see the man in the middle of this podcast, and like somewhere in the middle, it's like, do you want cheap domain names or do you? Do you want
big news story that I don't want to risk us forgetting. Mm-hmm. Flower 2 now has achievements.
Yes. Okay, I haven't actually checked out the achievements because I've actually been enjoying the Vampire Survivors Online multiplayer a bit. But, which I'm so sad that you can't do, because me, you and Hamish doing us Vampire Virgins or whatever.
I'll do it. I'll be up for doing it once. It's just, I'm just so burnt out on it.
Okay.
I'll do it as a group, you know, for the fun of a group activity. I'm just fucking, burnt out on it. But the Flat Out 2 achievements, I've got them all, and I want to challenge you, I want to lay down the gauntlet and challenge you to get all the sports ones, all the, you know, the bowling, the curling, the high
fuck
jump.
Fuck off, I had a
really fun day just getting all of those achievements.
Right, how do I find out where the achievements are? So it's Flat Out, on Steam or something, Flat Out to Steam. Yeah. Am I logged in? I'm probably not logged in because this is... it's 80% off at the moment. So if anyone
go
has...
Go get Flat Out. It's still the best racing game.
It's... How much is it? Because it's given me a bundle. Flat Out 3 and all the others. Like, there's like...
Oh, no, you don't want that.
No. It's four games for $6.99, but I'm sure you can get just the one...
Flat Out to
$8.50 here. Oh, it's only the bundle that's on sale. It's cheaper to get the bundle with Flat Out 2 in it than it is just to get Flat Out 2 on its own.
No, it's still not worth it. Just go to a key reseller or wait for the next sale, but get Flat Out 2. Or pay full price. I mean, it's only $8.50.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll just fire up Steam proper, and I'll see. We'll see. I'll see. I want to see what the
I did them, and I was like, I really wanted these achievements to be hard so that, like, I can feel cool for having them. And these are all too easy. Like, they only took me... There was a couple that took me, like, maybe... The field goal one was a pain in the ass. That took me maybe, like, half an hour, 40 minutes or something. But they're all a little bit, like, I got these too easily. Forgetting that I've been playing this game and practicing this game for 20 years. Because then I bullied Ghosty into trying to get a couple of them. And I started with the easiest one. And he couldn't get...
Oh no!
I'm like, I think I have a very skewed version of how easy these are. I think they are actually quite tricky.
For some reason, I don't even have it installed, and I'm kind of surprised because I'm sure me and Rosie were playing the other day. How did I uninstall it? Did something go wrong?
I can link you to. I think that page will work. That's my achievements, but I think that will work for just seeing the achievements.
Was I last playing it? Was I last playing it? Okay, so you've unlocked that. You've got 37 out of 37 achievements.
God damn right I have. Well, there's no way I'm not going to get the achievements in my favorite racing game ever that I've been playing for 20 years.
Okay, so Ghosty's got hobbyist, own 3 cars, legendary wingman, win
Yeah,
over 50.
it's all of those ones. I don't care. It's the sports event ones. It's the curling, the bowling, all of that stuff. Those are the fun ones.
Okay, so I've unlocked 0. So you have to start from, like, they don't give you the ones that you already have. Like, hobbyist, own 3 cars. How.
They do for those ones, yeah. But for the ones that are related to completing all of the race thingies and then getting into the finals, you have to do it on a new playthrough.
Okay. Same profile, or do I need a new profile for it?
Yeah, you need a new profile,
Oh,
yeah,
a whole new profile.
to do those ones. Yeah, to do those specific ones, yeah.
Okay. Get a fastest lap of 15 seconds or less in dirt speedway. Okay.
That one was actually quite, I find that quite challenging. That took me a good half hour to get that
Is that because your fastest lap is like ridiculously fast?
one. No. It's a track that never comes up in the main game. So yeah, I've no practice on it whatsoever. Yeah.
Top of the
That
world,
took
finish
me a
the
little bit.
finals. Okay.
But yeah, that's okay. They sort of on my one, they start from like if you go from the bottom, like the seventh one up or something, you get like three, score 390 in soccer, score 400 in baseball, 50 in basketball, perfect score in darts. All of those ones, those are the interesting ones.
Skipping
They
stones,
were
get
really,
1200 in stone skipping.
I just spent an afternoon just getting them all. I know it was really fun.
I was so shocked when, like, how, like, is there like a flat? There is a flat out two, like, sort of niche community, isn't there? Because whenever we play,
Oh yeah.
there's usually someone that comes along and wants to join in from, you know.
Yeah. So a lot of Russians and a weirdly high proportion of South Americans as well. I was playing a bit ago with a bunch of Argentinians, and they told me they were one of them was streaming on Twitch, like streaming the game, and then they and then so I was listening to their Twitch stream, like they were Argentinian, so I was speaking in Spanish, and I was trying to decipher as much as I could, and like they were shit talking me and stuff behind my back, and it was great.
Were you beating them all?
Yeah.
Oh,
They compared me to who was the famous like Argentinian Formula One driver? Was it There was a famous Argentinian Formula One driver, and they kept calling me that name, and that made me feel really good.
I couldn't tell you. I don't know shit all about Formula One.
I'll find him.
I don't even know if Jenson Button is British or Lewis Hamilton. I do know that Lewis Hamilton's vegan, which I don't know. Yeah.
That does not surprise me.
Does it not
Oh,
surprise you?
maybe he wasn't Argentinian. He's got not to be insulting to vegans, but he's got that kind of feel.
Kindness, that's
Like
the feel.
vegans are
Sweetness.
nice, are all lovely people, but the veganism does have this sort of like cultural association of being like a boring cunt, and he is a boring cunt.
Well,
I'm not saying vegans are boring. To be clear, you're a vegan and you're very unboring. It's
I'm sure
just it has
there's
that,
people
you
out
know.
there that think I'm boring. I'm sure. That's okay. Well, I'm gonna I will have to get through the flat out again. So I'm basically gonna have to go through career mode all over again.
Yes, yeah, you'll have to do all of career mode, yeah.
Okay.
But those are the less interesting ones. Do the sporting event ones first.
I
Oh,
like doing the sport.
that'd make a great own cast stream. You stream until you get them all.
Well, I'm starting my job on Monday.
Well, you know what you're doing tomorrow then?
Yeah, I got to. Well, I got to revise for my heavy goods vehicle theory test, which is yeah. It's quite. It's a few extra. There's a lot of questions about how tired or how like you can like. There's a lot of laws on how long you can drive for, and.
Yeah.
Around like tiredness kills and stuff, which makes a lot of sense because
Yeah.
if you fall asleep behind the wheel of a car, you're obviously more at risk as are your passengers and maybe one or two other people on the road. But if you're like a bus full
Yeah,
of
yeah.
children and you fall asleep at the
Yes, yeah.
wheel, that's
And a
just
bus is a big, heavy vehicle to plow into whatever it's plowing into as well, yeah.
yeah. And bus drivers obviously drive for a lot longer at a time as well. Like, it's not you're a bit snoozy and you're just doing the school run or whatever, but like, you know, so it's nice. It's nice. Like, the people I'm going to be working for do seem to have, you know, they seem to be particularly, you know, serious about all of this kind of stuff. So that's kind of
good. Yeah.
And, you know, they take all that kind of stuff seriously. So that's actually one of the reasons why I thought, like, the voice notes might be quite good. Because I set, basically on my website, I set up a little voice notes page, like a little one-person podcasty kind of thing. For just when I've got some time, I can then just do a do an audio cast and pop
Like on break, on breaks and stuff, you can do a little 5 minutes.
It might be the case that, yeah, if I got a break, that sometimes our breaks can be up to 90 minutes. And, you know, that's all fine. Like, you know, we get paid for it. But what do you do when you're killing 90 minutes? Like,
So on Monday, I assume you're not bus driving on Monday. I assume you're going into training or something.
We got, there's a like 4 weeks training and induction period, which is the least exciting bit of it all from where I am at the moment. Like, I kind of just want to get behind the wheel and get going. But obviously there's... there's all kinds of safety stuff, and I got to learn how to use the ticket. Apparently, learning how to use the ticket machine is the most difficult part. But I'm kind of hoping that most of the buses I drive will have that tap on, tap off system. Which, are you familiar with, having not been outside for a while?
No.
So basically,
last time I went on a bus, you tell them where you want to go, they tell you how much, you pay them, and they print out a little ticket.
Yeah. So nowadays, what you do on a lot, at least like vaguely modern buses, is you have a little terminal when you get on and you tap your bank card onto it, and then you sit down. And then when you get off the bus, you tap your bank card on the exit terminal, and then it just takes off the right amount of money.
Wow. So, can you not pay in cash?
I think you can pay in cash, yeah. I think there's still that option.
That's a very specific record of where you've been and when.
Yes. Well, it's the thing is with buses is that if you don't tap off, you just get a day pass. Like it maxes out.
Right.
So bus companies will have and it won't be too high, you know, but it'll be like travel as much as you can on the buses for a day. And it'll be, I wouldn't want to guess, but same thing with London, is that, you tap on and tap off. And it's super convenient.
For any murderers listening, maybe get a prepaid credit card or something.
Yeah, or paying cash. Although there's CCTV on all the buses now as well. Like, it's not the private way it used to be.
Why are they making murder so hard?
We're making murder very, very hard. Although, you know, to be fair, that puts me at ease because it means that at least, like, you know, shit that happens on the bus is like... Any trouble is like well documented or anything like that. So, not that I'm expecting it. Like, I'm driving these country routes. It's going to be mostly old people with bus passes, to be honest.
Yeah.
God, I wish we lived in a country where everyone could just have a bus pass. Although, to be fair, if everyone had a bus pass, you just wouldn't need a bus pass. Just make buses free.
Bus pass. Yeah, exactly. That's how it should be. Like, 100%.
Yeah, like the thing is, this is why, like, you know that capital still rules the roost, right? Because if a government was in any way serious about the environment, they'd just make buses free. Yeah. That'd be like step one, day one. Like,
serious about the environment and just making poor people's lives better.
Yeah.
Just make buses lovely and free.
Yeah. I mean, they subsidise them very heavily in London. Not so much the underground and stuff, but look how much they use it. And the underground's good. Like, it's...
Yeah.
It's good.
So like, just reminded me, did you see that post on Freddie? I think it was in the Netherlands or something. And it was, you know, those bendy buses that are like bendy in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
So four of them just happened to go onto a roundabout at the same time. Yeah. So they were trapped on like those parking games. You know, the sliding block parking games?
Yeah.
Or you just got to work it. Yeah. They were literally all trapped together. That was hilarious.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Like Chinese finger trap kind of thing.
Sorry for the cars in the middle of that roundabout.
Yeah, because they were literally they were boxed in. Yeah. In a wall of bus surrounding them.
A wall of bus. That's
That's going to be your nickname on Monday.
Chris
Ware.
I know that the Welsh Assembly, I shouldn't call it the Welsh Assembly, it's the Welsh Government, They're doing a lot with expanding buses. I think the Welsh
Good.
government are a little bit more sincere when it does come to that
Yeah,
kind of thing.
definitely.
They're still at the mercy of a lot, but
Yeah.
And they are for the most part social democrats rather more over anything else, but they're actual social democrats. There's a bit
No,
more of you.
I'd be happy with a spot of social democracy,
Yeah, it'd be a nice change from the fascism that we've sort of gotten ourselves stuck with.
yeah.
It's very nasty, not to get too dark or third, but it's very nasty to reflect on how many things have got worse since the Tories. Like, I've got a friend who is from Mauritius, and she had a job, and life was very normal for her, and she, has all her papers and everything, all very legally, and now she's getting put proper through the ringer just because Labour government want to make a show of performance cruelty. Like,
Oh my! Literally, a couple of weeks after Labour got in, my benefits were cut drastically to the point where I can't really afford to like heat and eat, as they say. Now it's
Christ.
very borderline. Yeah, and that's Labour coming in and doing
That's
that.
Labour.
That's great.
There was a post on Mastodon by one of the big sort of environmental campaigners, and they were talking about what like the environmental groups organizers were saying behind closed doors, and they were saying that again, even since the days of Truss and Sunak, Labour have made environmental policies a lot worse. They're absolutely terrified for what's to come. Like, it's you
No,
know.
this is yeah, it's weird to be living under a Labour government that's worse than the Tory governments that preceded
Yeah, that's kind of mad, really. So,
to
yeah.
I do have another nerdy one if
Yes,
you're
let's go back
interested.
to nerdy one before we get too sad.
This is very fucking nerdy. Very Linuxy. So I discovered that there's a thing called UKI,
Okay,
which is okay. So it's a kernel thing. It's universal kernel image. So you do not need a bootloader anymore since UEFI's been, well, I think this is the UKI thing has existed for a few years, but now you can make a kernel image that the UEFI can boot directly without the need for a bootloader.
Not even a systemd bootloader.
Not even a systemd bootloader. You just set up your making it CP, not making it CPIO. What's the one? Yeah, no, making it CPIO. You just set that up to basically it takes the kernel, it bundles it with the int RAMFS, it bundles it with any kernel microcode, and it bundles it with like a sort of shim loadery thing, and then your UFI just and then you run a little terminal thing to tell your UFI to boot that image when it boots. And your UEFI just boots that image, and it's glorious. No bootloader at all,
Is
or
it
no, no, you know, no.
is it faster?
It is faster, but my boot is so fast now that it's gone from like 5 seconds to 4.65 seconds. You know, it's but that's not the reason. But yeah, I just like the simplicity of it. Why you don't even need a bootloader? You know, especially if you're single booting like us. You know, like what? Why have a thing that you don't need at all?
I don't really, yeah. I dual booting with any other operating system always seems like such a faff to me. Like one Windows update
Oh
and
God, horrible. Yeah. I did it for a short while and it's just hassle.
it's just yeah,
So this
Windows
is
doesn't like it.
I've just done a tree of my boot partition, and that's literally all that's in my boot partition now. It's like it's nothing.
Okay. And wait, where's my terminal? Oh, I've closed my terminal. How about that? All right, so that's in your boot. So what's in my boot? Just oops. I've typed some things. Are you still on OBS? Okay, right.
So what?
Sorry, I typed to look in my boot, and I didn't know which window I was typing into, and I was worried that I might have screwed up my OBS, but I don't think so. So in mine, okay. How do you do that thing where you, oh, right, tree. I never use tree.
I very, very, very rarely used it, and Wing is another one that Wings put more in my head. It's useful, so I'm trying to use it when it is useful.
I actually don't have it installed.
Oh my God. What, I don't even know what package it's in.
Tree.
Oh, it's in
Okay.
just tree. Nice.
Okay, so this is my one. My one doesn't look particularly big.
Suddenly,
Right.
I mean, it's a lot bigger.
It's a lot bigger. So one, two, yeah, you got. So those are my kernel entries. That's what the loader loads.
You
Do
got the
you only
boot,
just load the one?
64.
Oh, so you got one kernel, and then you got a what's a fallback? So what's fallback? Is that like a
That's
safe?
a bigger, yeah. So if there's a kernel update that fucks the kernel over, that is a kernel with like all the safe options, I think, and like every driver I think included in the kernel is a lot bigger. You don't have to create that. I might stop creating that because I don't even remember the last time I used it. But yeah.
And that's
The
so
another one advantage of this that doesn't apply to me because I'm not doing it, but if you're secure booting, you've just got one file to encrypt. Because I think whether that's actually a benefit or not, it does seem to be argued, but the idea is that because if your kernel's signed, you can still somebody could still put in a spurious bootloader that just loads a different kernel. But if the thing that the EFI is booting directly is signed and that's the only thing, it simplifies the secure boot. But I don't care about secure boot, so it's not for me.
That
This is
would,
I just like the simplicity of it.
yeah. I mean that level of security is more than you need for a desktop machine, right? That's more like server stuff. That's
One of the problems with it from a Linux point of view is that all of the keys are ultimately signed by Microsoft.
for UEFI, you mean?
So secure boot is really a Microsoft thing. And what was the, and that does have actually security implications that I can't remember. But yeah, so I think part of it is like so all of the big Linux distros they get their keys signed by Microsoft keys, so then they can sign things. But they're still ultimately signed by Microsoft. But then that means you can get one of their bootloaders, stick it in, and make it do whatever you want. So it's basically there is no security. Something like, I don't understand these things, but it's something along those lines.
Okay, yeah. But
I was
can you not?
reading about it, but after I've read about it just all flies out of my head, you know?
Yeah, do we not turn secure boot off?
I do, yeah.
I can't remember now. You got to presumably go into the BIOS to check. This is stuff that you do once and then you forget for years. I might be wrong, but I think my B-Link came with like legacy booting as standard, like as default.
I think mine came with secure boot off. Yeah, because it comes. Does it come? Does Did they come with Windows or did they come without an? I
Oh
think they
no,
came without an operating system,
mine
don't
came
they?
with Windows and I didn't
I
even
did
boot
actually.
into it.
Yeah, I never booted it, so I'm not. There's no like sticker on it with a key or anything like that. So
No,
maybe
I
it
think
came
you
with.
need
I
to
don't
supply your
remember.
own key. I think you need to, yeah, or
Oh, I see. It works like that now. Okay, right.
I think it does. So you, well, I think it even works. I think it's like you log in with your Microsoft account and then it does everything from that. I
Oy,
think. Please correct me if I'm wrong. I
oy.
do not. Windows is not my specialist subject.
Horrible. Yeah.
It's only what I read from on.
There's the Arch Wiki page about the UKI if you want to do it. It's no particular benefits, but I like the neatness of it.
Okay, interesting. I get nervous when I mess around with stuff like this. I was
I
just
was
ref.
I was 90% sure it was just not going to boot because I forgot to do something, but it was all fine.
I was reflecting in my voice notes about the days when you had to modify the xorg.conf.
God, and you could do physical hot. You could destroy your monitor if you did it wrong.
Yeah, and it's just like,
Potentially.
I mean, I never did anything that bad, but I definitely screwed up some installs.
It was, I mean, it did, yeah, when you were installing Debian back in the day, it was like, what's the horizontal refresh rate of your monitor? What's the vertical refresh rate of your monitor? What, like a bunch of questions. And then the network card, it would ask, like, what, I don't remember, like, what the questions were, but very technical stuff about how your network card works. And it's like, I don't fucking know.
Yeah, that's kind of when like Ubuntu came in and saved the day a little bit. Or well, actually, to be fair, I don't know if how far we're going back now. It might have been things like SUSE.
There was Mandrake. I mean, they made a lot of things. Yeah, there was a bunch, but it was really Ubuntu that had that sort of got everybody on board with like, oh yeah, we need to streamline certain things to
Yeah,
give Ubuntu the credit, some credit.
my first mainstream distro was like Fedora Core 6, but that was like the first full-time I used Linux. But I'm guessing at that point in Linux history, they adopted a lot of a lot of that code might have come from Ubuntu. Like a lot of the ideas, a lot of the.
Well, the actual installer that Ubuntu always used was a Debian thing, if I remember right. They just sort of what Ubuntu that really the big sort of change that Ubuntu did really was not installing fucking everything. Because like I was saying earlier, when you got Debian or SUSE or whatever back in the day, the default installation installed every fucking thing.
Are you sure?
Your menus had like...
Are you sure that was how we did it? Because I don't get me wrong, I share that memory. Yeah. But are you sure that's not a case of when you install it, you don't entirely have all the confidence in all the settings, so you just put down yes in whenever in doubt?
No. That was true as well, but the default setting was to install like every text editor, every web browser, every version, every variety of every piece of software, and it was Ubuntu really who were like, let's have one text editor, let's have one, you know,
yeah,
one email client, one web browser, and you can install all the other stuff afterwards if you want to.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, and then of course you've got Arch.
I remember installing SUSE once and like whatever, I can't remember what desktop it was, but you know, clicking on the menu, the equivalent of the start menu, and it almost like didn't fit. It was like, it went off the screen. How much software was it? You know what I mean? It was like, it was doubled up.
I mean, I remember when I installed SUSE back in the day and it came with IceWM.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, wow, imagine having that installed out of the box. Still on i3, by the way. Still on i3. I can't see myself using anything else. I don't even have taskbars as well. You've kind of got me on the taskbars are unnecessary train. I've got like one key that I press that pulls up my bits and pieces in a set of notifications, which I think I talked about previously. I've got to-do list, calendar, and times and time zones and stuff. That's And also, actually, with LibreWolf, I've done the thing that I like that you do with Qt browser and that I also do with Qt browser, is put the tabs on that run down the left-hand side with icons.
Yeah.
Took me a while to get used to that, but it is infinitely superior because we've got wider monitors, so it makes sense to chip in
use the width rather than the height.
And I know people that use Windows that say that they are on laptops in particular who put their start bars along the left-hand side of the screen because on a trackpad, it is easier to swipe left than it is to curl your finger down. So
that makes sense.
Laptop users, that's a possible life hack for you. Consider having your taskbar on the left-hand side of the screen. Not only is it a more sensible use of screen real estate, especially considering how a lot of websites now are designed with mobile in mind, so that, you know, because obviously if you use a tiling browser like a tiling window manager like i3, you do a lot of browsing in half windows, and you do often see websites that will pop into mobile viewing mode. And that makes a lot of sense to me, you know, like I quite like browsing the web in a half window mode.
It doesn't make sense now because the web, it's always, you know, it's a text based thing for the most part, and text makes more sense in a relatively narrow column. Yeah. Mentioning i3, you reminded me on that the Qt browser crash thing that I mentioned. This is one of the devs' posts, which that amused me. I'll read that. I'm getting a crash report about this on a cadence of what feels like one every hour or two. So it definitely affects a lot of people. So far, almost all of them are on i3, with one or two being on DWM. But that might just reflect the Qt browser demographic. So really unsure whether it's... That is
honestly, I couldn't make that call either way.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, obviously, like, because it's not just they're that kind of nerd, but also... You know, they're text-based workflows. They slot in together so well. Yeah,
keyboard centric. It fits well into a Tiler when your hands are already on the keyboard.
Yeah, I think the thing is with Qt browser, I would have made more of an effort to slide into it, but it is the YouTube that kind of keeps me out of it. The YouTube ad blocking.
Yeah, with the user script, it is just a matter of, and honestly, it's about like. Because clearly YouTube is hostile for Firefox these days. And when I'm in Firefox, a lot of videos put, like, it takes a second or so before they start playing in Firefox, which isn't the case in, like, Chrome or whatever. So compared to Firefox, it's not that much worse, because what happens is I load a video, clearly the ads are loading in the background, I wait a couple of seconds while it speeds them up and skips them, and then the video plays. It's, like, a couple of seconds. It's not that big a deal.
Okay.
And I don't see the ads at all.
I mean, my Firefox, my LibreWolf now, is seamless. Like, I just don't get the ads, and it is quick. Like,
yeah, I did notice the other day when I was on Firefox briefly, it does seem to be better with YouTube now than it was last time I was using it. But that is unreliable, I think, because they do, you know, it's a cat and mouse between Mozilla and Google.
Yeah, because most of the stuff, I'm not a big like web apps kind of person. Like, I got my email, which doesn't have to be through the web. It just happens to be the Postio's mail client I really like. I've got my Mastodon. I've got WhatsApp Web, which runs pretty well on Qt browser, if I recall. Discord. Yeah, and the rest of it is just like PeerTube, YouTube. I got GitLab there because I made that merge request straight in through the website rather than, you know, doing all the Git stuff. My theory test, I got that.
Yeah.
I've done quite well. There's a lot of stuff on essential documents as well. I was quite good at the essential documents. The breaking systems can be a bit tricky because you've got when to use what break.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
They got an endurance. They got like, because it makes sense because there's a thing called an endurance break on a bus, which you apply when you're going down a steep hill for any length of time, because obviously you don't want to grind out the parking brake because the bus is a lot heavier than a car. And
yes, yeah.
And I'm assuming that there's also like the endurance brake is safer, so it's designed to stop heavy things going down hills too fast. And also, I think it might also, I don't know this because I haven't actually driven a bus yet, but I'd imagine the endurance brake keeps you at a steady speed, but you can still use the foot brake to adjust for hazards and things like that. So
and that all makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's going to be interesting. The next one we do when you are a bus driver,
yeah,
or at least a bus driver in training.
Yeah, I'm thrilled. I'm super excited. A little bit nervous because there's a lot of paperwork and stuff like that. But you know, I've passed the medical checks. I've the paperwork was all okay to fill out. So I can't imagine there's anything particularly disqualifying, but it's just, you know, the intensity of the paperwork. There's so much to get right for obvious reasons. You know, it's a role where you're in charge of public safety, so
yeah,
you can't shortcut these things. But if I can hack it, the pay's good, and the job seems secure, and it's got a good union. And it's local, and those are the things that I would work well for.
Yeah, those are the important things for sure.
Yeah, and fingers crossed that it ends up being a 4-day work week, but with longer shifts, because that's how, you know, that's more in line with how country buses work.
Should we wrap it up there?
That sounds like a good place to wrap it up. Yeah. So thank you everyone for joining us. Check out freebooters.uk. That's where all the stuff that we talk about will probably end up when it comes to free brewery stuff. Thank you everyone for joining us, and toodaloo.
Bye bye.